Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast. I'm your host, Michael Jordan, and I appreciate you being here. I just finished a really fun conversation with Jim Kreider, who is a certified financial planner and founder and owner of Intentional Living Financial Planning. Jim is a great guy, and a wealth of information came out of this conversation around his thoughts on a traditional 60-40 portfolio, his Bitcoin allocation, both personally and how he sort of guides his clients through thinking about how they might allocate to Bitcoin as well. I found this to be a very enlightening conversation, very enjoyable, and I think you will as well. All righty, everyone. Like I said at the in the intro, I've got Jim here. Jim, welcome to the show.
Hey, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this conversation. Like I was telling you offline, I've heard you on a number of pods and recently heard you on Preston's and just thought this is a conversation we need to have. I think we need more exposure to smart, thoughtful financial advisors speaking on Bitcoin. I think it's an area that is greatly lacking. And so my first question to you is actually sort of a joke and sort of a real question, but it's how lonely do you feel as a financial advisor that promotes Bitcoin?
I stay in a small lane. Mm-hmm. So yeah, if I venture out and go to like normal people world, it's weird. Actually sort of like doing that. I'm too busy with my work nowadays, but used to before I was super busy with my business, I would go to like conferences and continuing education sessions and stuff with like old man financial advisors and like wear a Bitcoin shirt just for fun. I sort of miss those days. Yeah, fortunately, I have a small group of other Bitcoin maxi financial planners that I run with, and they keep me company and encouraged. And how quickly I forget that we're the exception, not the norm.
Yeah, we're all sort of in our own echo chamber when it comes to Bitcoin to some degree, I suppose. Is that group of people, you find it growing? Has it been static over the last couple of years? What's the sort of the evolution of that group of Bitcoin financial advisors?
So I've heard talks about this, and I'll see people on Twitter or something sometimes saying like, oh, I think there's more advisors, or hey, Morgan Stanley or whatever firm, whatever X now has access to these ETFs. So they're going to start training their advisors to adopt it. And it's going to be this big thing. In my very small world of financial planning, that's not my experience. I would say that maybe there's slightly more adoption, but not really. If there's any quote unquote adoption, it's more just slight curiosity, or willingness to put out rebuttals versus ignore. Now, with that said, there is slight adoption, but it's nothing to get excited about at this point. I'm trying. I'm trying to get more advisors on board with this, but we'll see. I'm curious to see how this takes on. I had the opportunity to speak with Fidelity Investments, their digital group probably about a month or so ago, their digital assets group. That was a lot of fun, like trying to help them see how financial planners view this, because they're sort of in the world of their products. And hopefully I can shed some insights to them that will help start bridging these gaps between products and institutions, and then the actual people who are the boots on the ground working with clients.
Yeah. I think that's going to be an important role, because there has to be some group in the TradFi world that sort of begins the process of onboarding and forces everyone else in. And maybe like the ETFs are a vehicle for that. But I still think even for their relative success in the US, it seems like, to your point, I've seen very little movement from anyone in my life, at least, who is involved in financial services to learn or do anything different than they have in the past. And so I guess I'm curious, and I want to get into your Bitcoin background, you know, your origin story, but it seems like people are apathetic more than they're even hostile. Like, and maybe I'm giving people too much credit. You see a lot of hostility. There's plenty of that, but like most of the people who I've talked to are just disinterested in learning, or there's like, oh yeah, I don't get it. And it's like, well, this is a trillion plus dollar asset class. You know, it's probably something you need to consider figuring out. What do you think it is that is keeping, first of all, is that your experience? There's more apathy than resistance in traditional finance? And why do you think there is apathy to any degree when this is obviously a technology worth considering, at least?
Yes, of course, we can all think of those people who are more hostile, but mm-hmm. those are the exception, not the norm. They exist, mm-hmm. but they get attention because of their hostility. I'd say statistically, there's way more those who are just apathetic and quietly dismissing this rather than voicing a disagreement. As to why, I think it's a lack of awareness of it being an issue. And if there's not an awareness of an issue, there's no perceived necessity for a fix. Mm-hmm. So if you can shove the problem aside or not have it brought to your attention, of course, this thing sounds like magic internet money rather than a solution to our broken money system.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think you're probably right about that. And the other thing I think, too, is truly like this cryptocurrency, like the crypto market, I think confuses a lot of people because they think they need to be distinguishing between which is the right one or something. It's like, no, no, no. Like, that's noise. Focus on there's a problem and a solution. And if you just sort of simplified that. But then I guess my question to you would be, how would you... So if you're talking... I have a friend who is an advisor at Morgan Stanley, and he's just... his disposition has been apathetic. It's like, yeah, I don't get it. You know, how would you break down the problem? What is Bitcoin solving and why does he need to be interested? And you're talking to another CFP, not some goofball like me.
The way I found that this is most impactful is, well, my method is a fewfold. First off, allow them to voice anything that they know or think they know or have heard about it. That way they can get it on the table up front. So that's step one. Because again, if they have the thought in their head that, oh, Bitcoin's only used by drug cartels and human trafficking, then you could be bringing up the best points possible. But all they're going to be thinking is, so what? That just further enforces money that's used by these people I don't like. So you have to allow them to get on the table. And then once they've done that, they'll allow themselves to hear other things versus just dismissing. So you have to start with that. And then come in, just let them know, like, look, to understand this thing, it's going to sound silly unless we start off with addressing the root thing of what it's solving for. And that's, we have to look through the history of what are good forms of money and stores of value. So we have to go through a history lesson right quick on, yeah, what have been forms of money and sources of value throughout history. And that will lead us, in my opinion, logically to where we're at right now with our fiat system, the massive debt issue that I think we're all starting to see. Writing is on the wall with everything we have going on in the fiat side, and then Bitcoin. And that brings about a stronger juxtaposition between Bitcoin and our current monetary environment versus money as they see it, versus cryptocurrencies. And you have to establish, it has to be built on this foundation of what is Bitcoin, because Bitcoin, or what is money, because money is, Bitcoin is money. So you have to start with that. And I think that's where, again, maybe it's because I'm just not very good at understanding or explaining the technical side of how, like, the computational side of Bitcoin works. And also the people I'm trying to appeal to don't need to go there. And honestly, I would argue, I'm arguing myself right now, I would argue that even those who do have a strong technical computational understanding still need to understand the side for having a good form of money. So nonetheless, I think that you have to start with the foundation. Because if you go straight to, oh, the hash rate and mining and stuff like that, it's gonna be like, yeah, who cares? Like, you could have an amazing, my brain works with really bad analogies. Something like some terrible contraption, like a bicycle that's stacked up like 8 layers tall and has all these like weird things to it. And it's like, yeah, but look how it has all these neat gadgets to it. It's like, yeah, but it does nothing. It's like a normal bicycle, just worse. You're going to fall further if you fall off. Mm-hmm. And that's what Bitcoin maybe sounds like if you explain Bitcoin with, you just start throwing out hash rate and nodes and stuff versus starting with money. And building off of that. So that's where you have to go. And I think that's the problem with most financial planners is they're so ingrained with working with money and advising on money issues and things peripheral to money, stock compensation and all kinds of stuff, that very few of them have ever stopped to ask, but what is money? And again, it takes that question to actually begin going down the rabbit hole. And I think I would venture to say that most people who really understand Bitcoin now either initially fell into it through that question or started dabbling in it as a speculation and then were then forced to recognize that, oh yeah, this is a better form of money. What is money? So they, to get to where you are as a deep understanding of Bitcoin, you have to wrestle with that question.
So great answer. I think a lot of directions I could potentially take this. One thing I'm curious to understand. So another financial advisor I talked to, I was sort of going through the debt problem. And I think, first of all, many financial, I think they just take for granted that it's, we take for granted that's a problem, right? Like, I think there's some, it's like, well, we've just always done this. We've always printed money. We've always been in debt. Like, some debt's good. Some inflation's good. Like, we take for granted, like, how insidious all of these things are. The only thing that, the only sort of useful rebuttal I've heard is one financial advisor I talked to said, well, there's always, you know, the ability to raise taxes and do austerity. And in my mind, I mean, tax receipts are dependent on a lot of economic circumstances that are to some degree outside of your control. And austerity seems so politically impossible that so as to be an unhelpful thought exercise almost. Maybe that's an option, but it seems to me like it's, you know, I mean, you print or default at some point. Do advisors, in your mind, is your perception that advisors just don't see those as the two binary options and that there really are other ways of getting out of this debt problem? Or do they just not even think there is a debt problem?
I think that most financial planners don't even consider the monetary or macroeconomic environment. Mm. Then when you start going there, it's like, oh, you're trying to time the market or whatever. And like, they're, I think most, and again, I live in a small circle of financial planners out there. But pretty much all that I've ever talked to, this a conversation about global or US debt and like just the issues that we're aware of, it's not even part of a conversation, like ever. Maybe it'll come up because a client's asking about, oh, the debt, because it was like maybe here's when it would be addressed in my experience is when the government's about to shut down and we need to raise the debt ceiling. And at that point, they write some sort of talking piece. The advisor usually didn't write it because most financial planners rely on a third-party asset management platform or like a group behind the scenes that's not actually the planners who writes an article and a talking piece about, oh, raising the debt ceiling, don't worry, it's going to get approved and it'll keep marching on. So they review that email real quick, knowing they're going to get 19 phone calls from clients in the next couple of days. They have their talking points. They give their talking points with zero conviction or real understanding. They're just repeating something they just read and off they go. And after doing that for several years, you feel you forget that you're just parroting something you read from another guy back office. And you actually start feeling that it's actually truth. And that is my experience. I know it sounds like super harsh. Yeah, I don't think very few financial planners even consider this stuff. And I think what you're just mentioning a second ago with talking about the debt issue, and it's like, oh, well, we're so used to this. Well, man, so many things. Yeah, that's why you have to take this in context of not just the US. Like, this is an isolated thing. This has happened several times throughout history. And if you can help them see a pattern of like, oh yeah, other countries have experienced massive debt and massive monetary issues. What happened to them? Oh, well, it didn't work out well for them. Why was that? What did that decline look like? Once you can start seeing patterns, and not a repetition, but certainly a rhyme, they'll maybe hopefully start putting the pieces together. That, or they're just ignorant or arrogant. Honestly, I think I don't know if it's more arrogance or ignorance that's out there, but I think it's a very unhealthy mix of the two that keep people in the dark.
Yeah, and then, I think it. Oh yeah, go on.
Well, lastly, the piece of like, well, the government can always create more money or they can always raise taxes. It's like, yeah, okay. Well, how did that work for Rome? How did that work for Weimar Germany? Like they were a sovereign nation who could have just kept doing these things, but they got to the point where you couldn't until you couldn't. And I think one day we'll get there. Like, hopefully not, but there's a chance if nothing changes. We're sitting here saying, like, you can always raise taxes. You can until it doesn't work anymore. So, and again, like, if that was the solution, why have other countries who have collapsed under their massive debt problems not just raise taxes if that's easy?
Yeah. It seems like there's just a playbook that people coming out of business school have. It's like, you know, 60-40 portfolio, like all these sort of just heuristics that, you know, make it sort of easy to imagine that we have a particular level of control. And I think most people, myself included, are not great students of history. Like, I've picked up so many bits and pieces as I've gone deeper down the Bitcoin rabbit hole, but I haven't read a lot of books on the fall of Rome, right? Or things like that. And it's easy for people to look back in history and it's like, well, this time it's different. I think it's kind of, even if people aren't consciously thinking that, there's sort of the subconscious, like, no, we're the United States, you know, at least, you know, on this side of the Atlantic. It's like, no, we're the United States. It's not going to happen here. It couldn't, you know, we're the land of the free, whatever that, you know, the mantras are that they repeat to themselves. And the reality is there are, you know, very important lessons throughout history that we should be taking wisdom from, and we aren't different. And actually, I think my thesis, to the extent that it's worth anything, is it's going to unravel faster for us than it did for Rome. Like, we live in a digital age in a more competitive global economy. We're competing with a lot of other currencies. Now there's Bitcoin. There's still historical, you know, artifacts like gold. You know, there's a lot more going on, and everything just can play out a lot faster than it could when messages were delivered, you know, by horse. So I don't know. There's a specific question in there. Is that sort of how you see it? Is like, we are getting closer to the end game, and it's hard to see. Like, I know in the end game could be another 50 or 100 years, but like, we're getting closer to that. Or do you think that the sort of dance goes on a little bit longer and they're able to keep, you know, kicking the can down the road?
I mean, we're getting closer. Now what that means, I'm not sure. Like, whenever we're driving anywhere, my kids always ask, like, are we there yet? And my response is, well, we're closer than we were. Yeah. As long as we're going in the right direction, we're getting closer. And I think that's what's happening, is to, like, you know, maybe we're 15 minutes out of the driveway on a 7-hour road trip. We're still getting closer. So I don't know where we are on this road trip, but we're getting closer. I can tell you that. Mm-hmm. And I would agree. I think this will unwind in a quicker manner, because there's more exit routes. And there's we have the benefit, I guess, of virality with these things as well. So, I don't know where we are on this. Going back to your point, as far as people who come out of, like, schools and stuff, and the portfolios and just what you've been taught, I have the benefit here. I was a really bad student. I sort of camp on small things whenever they come up in class. One, I realized too late in life that if I'm not on the front row, or like pacing in the back row, I'm checked out. I have to be on the front row asking all the stupid questions, or like in the back of the class moving around so I can engage. I didn't know that until the very, very end of school. So I just never paid attention at all. But what I came to realize is how my brain works. I camp on little tiny things that's hard for me to get past. And if I can't get past that thing, how in the world am I supposed to keep building on other topics? Like, mm-hmm. topics on top of that. Like, I don't have a framework to keep building on. And I think that's where I think it's benefited me, honestly, because I stop and ask what are probably stupid questions to most people. But honestly, I think they're dumb questions that most people have. Like, mm-hmm. If we're talking about, economics, and something comes up that just is left field, and everyone else is going to sit there and just take notes, knowing they're like, all right, cool, I know the answer. Like, I can't remember those. Like, I can't remember the wrong answer, because my brain won't let it stick. So I'll ask the question, like, why? Like, I'm probably misunderstanding, but how does that work? And, you know, usually those types of questions usually get a sigh. You know, if you ask a group of, if you're in class, it's like, hey, money is this, and it's a dumb answer for money, my brain will not it can't capture that because it's trying to put it into a thing that makes sense. So I try to just reframe, and it's a genuine question like, okay, so can you just re-explain what is money? Or, yeah, why do we have this debt, but yet we can continue to create it, but we're in debt to ourselves? Like, tell me again, how does this work? And if it's not a valid answer, like, my brain will just dismiss it, so I have to get an answer. So I'll just keep asking it. And everyone else wants to move on so they can get a good grade. And I think that's where being willing to just sort of be look foolish for the sake of actually learning comes in handy. And I think that's where I see that a lot in the Bitcoin space is being willing to ask those goofy questions and really being curious. You see that a lot amongst like successful entrepreneurs as well. People have oftentimes dropped out of school because they saw a non-need for a lot of things. And it was like, we're asking the wrong questions. And I'm not saying I'm super special in that sense. Again, I think it just comes back to like these group of people who come out of, you know, like their MBA or whatever, there was lack of thinking and more regurgitation.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't want to put words in your mouth, but this was my experience in college is everyone was there to get the degree. And I think the quest for knowledge has just dissipated. Like no one is like, there are very few people I knew in college who were doing anything but studying hard to just earn the degree and be able to regurgitate whatever the professor said. And I think it sounds to me like you were asking the obvious questions that everyone should have been asking if they were paying attention and trying to absorb and think through this. But we've sort of grown up into this education system where it's like, what the teacher says is correct, pass the test. Like that's what you got to do. Just listen to what they say and pass the test and you'll succeed. Did you study finance? Was that your degree?
No, it was just general business. I didn't know anything about finance and stuff until I was 25 or so. I knew I wanted to own businesses in some capacity that were all related by some sort of theme. But that was as far as I knew.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause I'm thinking back. So I wasn't a finance major, but my sense was that you had like the econ and the finance majors. And to be clear, like the econ majors were probably just learning Keynesian nonsense and, you know, that sort of thing. But I don't sense there was a lot of overlap. Like you took, if you were in the business school, you took basic economic, like probably micro and macro or something like that. I think we had to take, and that was the extent of it. And so there was no real depth that a finance major, which a finance major would have grasped economic concepts, even if they were teaching the right economic concepts, which I'm sure they weren't. I don't really remember too clearly. They weren't teaching Thomas Sowell or Milton Friedman or anyone economics, like that, much less Austrian, you know, like
economics made zero sense because it was all Keynesian. It was like, yeah. I don't get any of this. And
yeah,
frankly, I think it's because it literally doesn't make sense. It's not because I'm stupid. Like you're teaching them doesn't make sense. So,
yeah. it's almost a sad indictment of the education system that people aren't, that they're learning all these things that don't make sense and they aren't asking questions to understand why they don't make sense. They're just trying to make sure that they understand what the teacher is saying enough to answer the question. You know, it's a sad state of affairs. So, hey, let's take a step back. So how did you find Bitcoin? Talk to me about your Bitcoin journey.
Yeah, I first heard about Bitcoin in 2012 from a guy I worked with. He always asked our boss to pay us in Bitcoin. And my boss told him that's because he just wanted to have more Bitcoin to buy stuff on the Silk Road. I latched onto that comment. I was like, what's the Silk Road? And was curious about dark web. Like I'm very naive and innocent. So I was like, what in the world are you talking about? And unfortunately, I latched on to the Silk Road dark web side of things rather than the Bitcoin side of things. So forgot about it until like 2015, late 2015-ish, started remembering these things and got a little bit curious. And then Preston Pish and Stig Reuterson started talking about it in more of a curious manner on their show, in context of more like value investing. And that reminded me like, oh yeah, this thing. And that forced me to start, getting a little bit more curious. I mean, heck, at that point it led into the 2016 then 2017 Bitcoin bull market. And I remember having people hearing about people, I was working at a large firm then, hearing about people who were like in their 60s and 70s wanting to like take a HELOC on their house to buy Bitcoin. I remember that like January of 17, like when it was like at 17,000, 18,000, hearing people wanting to mortgage their houses and stuff. It was like, and at that point I didn't understand this and I just thought it was totally crazy, which look back and that was a totally crazy time to do that. But I didn't have a basis of like even why that should be, not should be, why that would even be something that could be considered as a valid option. Like to me, it was like, you might as well be mortgaging your house to
for Pokemon cards or
yeah, something
Beanie
like that.
Babies or something.
I had no, like now if someone came to me and said, hey, Jim, I'm looking to get a line of credit on my house and go buy Bitcoin, it's at 70,000. Like, okay, let's put that on the table and at least discuss it. And through good talking points at that point, that was a non like conversation. Yeah. So, and it was in March of 20 when, I remember like it was probably like November, December, I started hearing about things going on in China and with COVID. And then obviously throughout early 20, things started progressing. And then March of 20, I was like, wow, this is, the world and the economy and the government interference as we've ever perceived it, or at least in my lifetime, you know, people who were around in the 30s and stuff are aware of how the overreach. But in my lifetime, that was the first in-your-face example of the government coming in and, in my opinion, overreaching in ways that forced me to consider, is there something else that the government can't come in and massively intervene with? So that forced me in March of 20 to start going down this deep rabbit hole of gold and the gold mining process, silver, other precious metals, further down the line, also just on regular, like other commodities, and then also Bitcoin. And at that point, like I would just go on super long walks and read all day for a while. And then landed on like, okay, I think what we need to do is it's Bitcoin. And at that point, that was like March of 20, I just moved all of our money over to Bitcoin. And yeah, that was tough. I was working at another firm where I would regularly try to get the other advisors. I was on our investment committee. So I tried to get them to talk to clients about it. And that was a no-go. So that was difficult having all of my money in one spot and not being able to do that with clients. I can't be duplicit in that sense. So at that point the writing was pretty clear that I need to leave there and start my own firm. So
yeah.
Here we are.
So I'm curious, and you don't have to answer this question. When you say all in Bitcoin, like is 100% of your and anything that you're not spending on, you know, paying bills or whatever each month, are you 100% in Bitcoin?
Yeah. So I do own a few stocks, but those stocks that I own are also Bitcoin related. So like MicroStrategy and a handful of miners that I bought back in March of 20. But that's about what I, that's it. I own a couple of companies. So my balance sheet, yeah, liquid net worth is Bitcoin or Bitcoin related companies. And then I own my businesses. Yeah, we're renting right now in anticipation of building. But yeah, we were like, all right, babe, let's go ahead and sell our house so we can buy more Bitcoin with those proceeds. And then we'll build a house and we can pay cash for that once we sell our Bitcoin. And I know that sounds nuts. And I wouldn't necessarily advise clients to do what I'm doing. I'm open to having these conversations. I forget that it's weird to talk about money because I talk about it all day.
Yeah.
Yes. Long story short, and I'm open for any other questions you have in that field if you want to go deeper.
No, well, no, so it's interesting. So I convinced my dad to buy some Bitcoin, and he read Lynn Alden's Broken Money. I think that maybe was the first. He went from like he had bought some just because I said, hey, like just get, please, dear God, please just buy a little bit, to now he's DCA, you know, he's dollar cost averaging into Bitcoin each month, which is, you know, I think great. And he sort of took initiative and asked me where he should buy and that sort of thing. But I sent him your interview that you did with Preston. which was a great one. I thought I told him, my dad, my family were all Christians. I was like, hey, here's a thoughtful Christian guy who knows his stuff. He's not doing, you know, anything crazy. Just listen to him talk to my, you know, the guy who does my favorite podcast. It's a good interview. And he called me and we talked about it a little bit. And he's like, yeah, one of the things he said, though, he said, you know, yeah, like probably on average, I think he said something to the effect of like on average, maybe your clients would have 30% of their net worth in Bitcoin, or I think 30% came up as like a number that people would have in Bitcoin. And he's like, I mean, that's crazy. But I was like, well, I was like, keep in mind, though, like the people who Jim's probably working with and referring to there have spent hundreds or thousands of hours studying Bitcoin, learning about the flaws of our current monetary system, projecting into the future, where does this lead? And they're making this sort of informed decision. And presumably part of what they're working with Jim for is understanding what is your tolerance and your ability to go 30% or more into Bitcoin. And for some people who are, you know, living on fixed income or things like that, you know, they're probably less, I would imagine, than someone who, if they got wiped out today, if Bitcoin disappeared, could start over and it would be relatively inconsequential, for example. So I'm curious how you think about sort of the allocation of Bitcoin. My dad's a smart guy. He just hasn't gone down the rabbit hole the way I have and the way you have and probably many of your clients. I'm curious, like, how you think about constructing a portfolio with Bitcoin as a part of it.
Yeah, it's a weird job. so most of the people I work with come to us not owning Bitcoin already. Now that's changing now. I'm getting more Bitcoiners who are coming on, and we're integrating Bitcoin. We're building portfolios around their Bitcoin versus, you know, they're looking for a normal financial advisor and I introduce them to Bitcoin. But that's the vast majority of our clients are normal people looking for a financial planner, and they get rug pulled and a couple months later they own Bitcoin. let's see. No, I mean, allocations, it's pretty high allocation. And I'm not doing that because, like, that's a go-to stamp thing that I put on there without any thought or conversation with clients. When I started this company, it was 21. So I started bringing on clients like March or April of 2021. And at that point, we had most of our clients were putting in about 10, maybe 20% of their total investable assets to Bitcoin. And we had conversations about having cycles and the run-up and all these things. And then in November of 22, when it bottomed out, really, I remember at that point, like I wrote an article, or I was featured in an article for, I don't know, like Financial Advisor Magazine or something like that. And they interviewed a handful of advisors asking about cryptocurrency. It was the collapse of FTX and the impacts. And I was quoted like, no, we're putting our foot on the gas and buying more right now. And I love that I'm quoted there because it's like proof of work. It is written there. So yeah, at that point. So right after that, so February of 20, when would this have been? February of 23, I guess, Bitcoin was starting to climb back up, but it was still like maybe like 20,000. We have all of our annual reviews with clients February and then August. So February of 23, when Bitcoin was around 20, like I remember telling clients like, hey, like generally speaking, we should probably look at increasing this. And our average client was like 10 to 20%. And we started increasing like 20% to higher. So at that point, like I'd say our average client started moving their total investable assets allocation to Bitcoin closer to about 35%. And obviously just with the Bitcoin's appreciation, that has now consumed a larger percentage of their portfolio. That came at the time of like, hey, this is going to be like where we're at right now. I don't think this is going to sustain. We're probably going to see appreciation. That did work out well. Right at this moment, I think of all the clients we work with, I think the smallest allocation of anybody is a 10% of their total investable assets. But yeah, I would say still like the median is really high. And I don't know. most financial, and I disclose all these things. Like, look, most financial planners, when I say most, I mean like 99.9% will tell you that you shouldn't own any. And those that will say that you can own some, they're not advising it, but they'll allow you to own some basically to get you to stop asking. They'll tell you to put 2% of your portfolio in there and just be done with it. And again, that's just a way of silencing you rather than they're just appeasing you. So, yeah, to go where we are sounds crazy, but again, this has to be done in context of a total financial plan. You better really be dialed in on especially if you're retired, like, okay, or not even just retired. If you need that money in a relatively short period, you better have a really good order of operations with how and when you're going to pull out from these different buckets of money. So yeah, I'm not putting people into Bitcoin if they need that money in like 6 months, if they're retired. Like, I mean, my wife and I, we carry a small emergency fund, but outside of that, yeah, all of our money's in Bitcoin. And we plan on spending some of that in a year to go buy a few acres. And you could say like, oh man, it's, again, like usually the thought there is you should have a 4-year horizon if you're going to, when you buy Bitcoin, before you're going to need it. So I know that I'm going against that common advice of wait 4 years because I'm going to need that in 1 year. But if we're going to do this at a 1-year time frame, I think now is the time to do it. Yeah. Now, if it was a year from now, I would not be telling people to invest that heavily into Bitcoin, especially in the context of you might need this money in the short term. So we are massively aware of these things because we're so overweighted. There is a place of being somewhat active in rebalancing portfolios, and like around a year and a half from now, we will start dollar cost averaging out of Bitcoin positions into more traditional assets and reducing. Because again, right now if we're at 35%, I would anticipate that being like 80% of a portfolio in a year from now. We're going to get back down to a more prudent level of 10 to 20%. So we're going to DCA back down into that spot. And then sit on the sidelines, wait for, I don't know if it's going to happen, but if the market drops or if Bitcoin drops following the normal ebbs and flows of the price cycles, then we'll get back in and reestablish a larger percentage. So yeah, I wouldn't drop your dad at 50% and just tell him good luck for the rest of his life. Like, we would keep a very close eye on that if that was even the case.
Right, right. So when you talk about sort of reallocating, you know, Bitcoin goes up 10x, and so now suddenly someone's portfolio is at 80 or 90% Bitcoin, and you say, hey, let's get that back to something more reasonable. Are you talking about just selling, paying capital gains taxes and buying other assets, you know, with the proceeds, or how do you think about that?
Possibly. So we're trying to manage this in a way that's optimized for tax purposes. I don't want the tax tail to wag the investment dog, mm-hmm. certainly. But if we're going to sell something, ideally we're doing it in a tax efficient manner. So, maybe if you own some Bitcoin inside of a Roth IRA and maybe you're half there and half in your other assets, like, okay, we should probably sell at least some of those dollars come from the Roth IRA bucket, to make things easier there. So, yeah, but I think of what they're in Preston's podcast talking through. If you're going to sell, like, you better be pretty confident that you're going to, let's say you're in the 20% capital gains roughly bracket, you better know that you're going to capture this drop by at least 20% to make up for that tax hit you're going to take. Mm-hmm. So there's part of that conversation, but you have to remember, like, I am managing not just spreadsheets, but people's emotions. So, I mean, if your dad was 35% Bitcoin, and he's excited because this went up a bunch and like financial security is looking very great for him, and suddenly that 35% of his investable assets gets hit by 80%, like, most people will not react well to that. And not just react, I'm not worried about my job and reacting well to me. I'm thinking about their emotional state. So I have to manage around that too. So yeah, my job's weird. I manage, like, my whole job in its sense is like doing a puzzle every day for 90 families. I just do this big puzzle where there's new pieces that are always being thrown in. And those pieces can be the economy or tax reform or new job or starting a business. There's always new pieces just being thrown in as I work this thing out. And there's also like human emotions involved. So I know I feel like I'm giving you non-direct answers, but like, that's why so much of my job is just having really good conversations with people. Like, a lot of my job is very little of actually telling you do this thing. Most of the time it's let's just put everything on the table, where you're at, how you feel about things, and then all of the options available, let's just put on the table and just talk about the opportunity cost and everything with this and make an informed decision. That's huge, is to help people be able to look around the corner and see, if I go this route, what are all the opportunities? Okay, now let's examine each piece by piece, those decisions that could be had.
Got it. Yeah. I'm not expecting necessarily direct answers, just so much, because I understand it's a case by case basis. There are so many factors to the sorts of things that you have to think about with each client. So then could you, before I forget this, to what extent do you view gold or other commodities like that as like a hedge or a small piece of, just preserving purchasing power as part of a portfolio? Or is that just like, for you, kind of off the table for most people?
So the way that we invest is what's called a core and satellite portfolio approach. So core portfolio in general, so a normal client comes in, core portfolio will be generally like index-based ETFs. We're just trying to capture the market in a tax-efficient, fee-efficient manner. That's the core. Satellite portfolio is where we're trying to do something different. And for most of our clients, that satellite is right now in Bitcoin or Bitcoin-related positions, trying to capture alpha. We have clients who own Bitcoin. I also manage a portfolio that is, at the moment, it's highly Bitcoin-related. But I have the opportunity, if I want to change that, I will. And that's where next year, I believe, we'll start DCAing out of those positions into other things that are more for capital preservation. I do manage a second portfolio at the moment that is, I actually built this specifically for new clients that were coming on who had very heavy Bitcoin positions. Basically, their core portfolio was Bitcoin, and we need to build a satellite position for that. And that portfolio is a weird sort of Frankenstein thing. And that does have a little bit of gold in it, has a lot of commodities at the moment. It also has a lot of value and deep value funds. Our international weightings are odd. It's this weird thing that I'm trying to basically build in a way that's like, how do we make something that's as uncorrelated to Bitcoin as possible, but also is cognizant of still the monetary and macro environment? Because most of the people who come to me with very high Bitcoin allocations still want something that's not related to Bitcoin necessarily to hedge that risk. But they still don't want to pretend that the market is like, oh, it's just by index funds. So yeah, that type of portfolio does have a little bit of gold in it. And yeah, at the moment, oil and gas positions, it's just a weird thing.
Yeah, heavy commodity, yeah. Like useful stuff that everyone needs all the time that perform well in any, any environment.
Yeah, that, and like I said, a lot of like value and deep value. Basically, you own a lot of Bitcoin, let's say the Bitcoin goes down, not because of a 51% attack, but because of like this macro event that just demolishes every like risk on asset, then what should we own there? And that's really what we try to build around, but in a super diverse manner.
Hey, just a quick break and we'll get back to the show, but I want to introduce you to our very first sponsor of the Bitcoin Way podcast, Satoshi Coffee Company. Satoshi Coffee, sats.coffee is the URL. They make high quality, fresh roasted coffee, and they even put the block number to show proof of work on each bag. If you're watching on YouTube, you can see that. I'm not a coffee snob, but I'm sort of picky about what I do enjoy. And this Satoshi blend, which is one of their more popular blends, is incredible. They also have a blend from El Salvador and a couple of others. I'd highly recommend you trying out all of them. But the cool thing about Satoshi Coffee Company is they are Bitcoin only and only accept Bitcoin as payment. And as a Bitcoin Way podcast listener, you get 6.9% off if you go to sats.coffee and enter code TBW69. Again, Satoshi Coffee Company, sats.coffee. Check them out. Support Bitcoin only companies like Satoshi Coffee Company. Yeah. So how would you frame, my sense here, Jim, is that you are not a believer in the 60-40 portfolio. So I'm curious if that's an accurate statement, or maybe you are, maybe it's 60% Bitcoin, 40% Bitcoin proxies or something, but how would you like, what's sort of the fallacy of that portfolio? It like, has it done well for 40 years, say, as everything's kind of gone up, money printing, you know, like we've had a very soft economic environment, I think, for a 60-40 portfolio to function. And I think my sense is we suffer from recency bias and assume that the last 40 years are just going to continue in perpetuity. What's your beef with 60-40?
Oh, man. So I'm sure you've probably heard of the 4% rule, Trinity mm-hmm. study. Okay.
Yeah.
So the 4% rule was built utilizing a 60-40 portfolio. And where if you retire and you need to live off those assets for 30 years and adjust that amount annually for inflation, that, again, that was using a 60-40 portfolio. And the gentleman who's designed it, his name's Bill. When Bill first did this, he used all the data that was available. And I think that went back down to like 1926. So that was considering if you retired in 1929 or if you retired in 1970. So it did consider like really bad monetary environments. I think through the 70s with stagflation and also bad like economic environments. And Bill redid this study, I think in 2019, and used more data, different, like better diverse portfolio of more small cap and mid cap and also international weightings and also more diverse bond portfolio. And that was able to actually increase that safe withdrawal rate from 4.2% up to like the mid fives. So Jim Kreider, the certified financial planner, would say, yeah, 60-40 portfolio is built to weather these things. That's literally what it was for, is worst case scenario. Now, there's a lot of danger in saying this time is different, because this time is usually not different, but all you need is this time to be different once. And that sounds foolish, because everyone who says this time is different thinks that this time is the one that's different. They think it's the one. But I know I'm talking in circles, but yeah, I generally would not just throw a client in a 60-40 portfolio. 60%. This is how most people invest, for especially people who are about to retire or are retired, is 60% global stock portfolio, maybe like of their stock portfolio, probably like 70% US, 30% international, something like that. And then their 40% bond portfolio weighted through different durations, long and mid and short duration bond funds, and call it a day. And that's where I would disagree. Like for right now, pretty much all of our clients who do own any type of bond or money market positions, like we're in like short or ultra short duration bonds. And that is more for, again, like more capital preservation. Like we could move to longer duration bonds or bond funds in anticipation of the Fed pivoting and interest rates going down, thus bond values going up. But that also comes at the thought, there's not just will the Fed pivot and drop rates, but will the trust in our that other people have in our government's ability to pay that debt remain? Thus, we also see that buoy of bond prices. And I don't trust both of those with in risk-adjusted terms. Maybe that happens, but I can also just grab a money market fund and pick up 5% right now. So on a risk-adjusted return basis, is that worth it? And in my opinion, no. There's that. And then, yeah, we are certainly more tactical in how we invest. And that's very different than most advisors. Most advisors are, and again, the ones I come across generally are very passive. If you mention anything about macro, monetary, tactical investing in any sense, they're going to say that, oh, you're just trying to time the market. And it's all about time in the market, not timing the market. And they'll throw out statistics as far as like, had you missed the 10 best days, then blah, blah, blah. But I think there's some good into that, but you also have to recognize that everyone is active in some capacity, even if the limit of your activity is just identifying your allocation between U.S. and international or whatever. So, way more than you asked for.
No, that's great. I like that answer. So, okay, you're going to pivot back to something we talked about before. So you're effectively 100% in Bitcoin, which tells me that you think at some point Bitcoin becomes immensely valuable, not 70K valuable or 60K valuable, but much more than that. And for that to happen in sort of a I mean, it's happening already in a meaningful way, I suppose. But for that to really happen in like a way that would materially change your wealth from what it is today, I think there needs to be sort of an exit from the dollar and from our current system. And I'm curious, I assume you sort of directionally agree with that. I guess what the question I'm getting at, though, is how do you view that taking place? Is this like, this is a question I ask everyone. Is this like the peaceful revolution that we as Bitcoiners are hoping for? Do things have to get really messy and painful and like deep depression or hyperinflation first? Like, how does this all play out?
I have no clue.
That's the right answer. That's the right answer. If you were to speculate,
I don't know. That's why I think not owning any of this is equally, if not riskier than owning too much. Hmm. Going back, I mean, it's sort of going back to like the 60-40 portfolio, like. I think there's a good chance the 60-40 portfolio in nominal terms will do all right. The problem is we have nominal returns. Let's say nominally it does its job of 7% per year or whatever. Okay, that's great. But then we look at inflation adjusted returns, and that's just inflation against CPI. How are you doing there? Okay, now let's look at it a step further. So we have nominal, then inflation adjusted. Now let's look at it just as the opportunity cost of throwing 5% of that into Bitcoin. So now we're weighing it of the opportunity cost of had you done something else. And that's another frame of reference. So nominal, risk or inflation adjusted, opportunity cost. And then finally, if we actually consider not just opportunity cost of owning Bitcoin, but pricing it in Bitcoin, that 60-40. So then we're having like our inflation adjusted there, and inflation being the growth of Bitcoin. And that's where you start really seeing, like, I probably should own some of this. Again, like, there's a decent chance a 60-40 portfolio for a 70-year-old will do all right. I don't know. And probably. But you have to view it not just – you can't stop at that one lens. You have to consider it through all of these lenses. And if Bitcoin does really well, we have to recognize that will do well to the expense of something else. It can do well, again, in nominal returns. Let's say the government just doubles our the money in motion. Well, suddenly like Bitcoin could double, and nominally it doubled, but in real returns it did nothing. But if we're going to see real returns in Bitcoin, that literally has to come at the expense of another asset. Those other assets, real estate, gold, or that 60 or 40, or I mean, it could be a couple other things, I guess. That's it. So if we think that Bitcoin's going to go up, you better know that that's in real terms, that will come at the expense of other things. So again, that is yet another place of like minimally buying this as a hedge of what if I'm wrong. But I would say that is a starting ground of it being a hedge that you can't end there, though. Does that help at all, like sort of frame, like this is how I view like traditional portfolios versus like crazy Bitcoin guy portfolio, and like this spectrum of like views and context to place these things in as you weigh decisions.
Yeah. So let me share sort of my base case in the nearer term. I don't even know what that means, if it's in the next year, 5 years, 10 years, but it's somewhere kind of in, you know, call it the next 10 years maybe. And that is, I think the first thing that we will see play out is social unrest, because here's my sense, and I need to get the numbers on this right. I always say, like, call it 50% of our country has assets that can appreciate and either kind of match or maybe beat inflation, or at least mask the impacts of inflation enough that they're getting by. And then 50%, again, I'm making up the number, but 50% don't. And so they are getting demolished by inflation. And the reality is, we can say CPI is whatever we want it to be, but the reality, the you know, when you go to the grocery store, if you can no longer afford your groceries, you're forced to steal them or something, like, right? I mean, people get desperate. And my sense is that we're reaching that point where enough of the country, and I'm speaking for the United States, you know, you got different economic circumstances, probably many similar around the world, but in the United States, there's going to be a large number of people who just take to the streets and protest, and maybe it gets violent, hopefully it doesn't, but, you know, starving people are desperate people, and they're going to want some sort of change. I think that's kind of when we begin to see the cracks really show, like not just on paper, you know, we can look at the debt levels and all that, but like, that's when we begin to see the cracks really show. And what I haven't figured out is like, what happens if I'm right about that, which I don't know, but if I am, what happens after that? Like what changes? Like, does everyone suddenly rush into Bitcoin? Probably not. There's an education hurdle and a lot to think about, but does that make sense as maybe an initiating, you know, this sort of initiating event that would then lead to other things unraveling?
Yeah. And I think that will coincide with, so what I think is going to happen is within the next decade, us and every other major economy is going to have primarily CBDCs. And those CBDCs will come with a handful of other things attached. At first, it's going to be, hey, this will just make it for easier spending. And then quickly, soon after, or maybe in tandem, we'll introduce some sort of universal basic income. And that will be a secondary motivator to adopt their CBDC and also to appease these riots or this feeling of, where's my money going? Oh, well, don't worry. We'll give each family $500 per month. And that will help appease these things. People not recognizing that $500 per month is coming at the expense of your wallet in 14 months.
Yeah, you know? A year, yeah.
But I think that'll come. And then I also think that relatively soon after, or in around the same time frame, those CBDCs will be tied to some form of social like spending system where like, hey, you ate too much red meat. Or, hey, why'd you spend so much gas? Like, instead of your $500 this month, you're going to get $200. Do it again, you're not going to get any next month. And I know that sounds probably similar to tinfoil hat, and it certainly did when I was thinking of those things 4 years ago, but now it's starting to, I think people are starting to realize this. And I think this is where it ends up. And so where we're at is this battle of like, it will be perceived as Bitcoin is a digital currency, and so is my CBDC. But my CBDC, I get free money. But that is Bitcoin. So like people say, is like Bitcoin is freedom money, and that is like we are getting more and more enchained and enslaved to the money creators through CBDCs. And like it's just, you're going to see a stronger and stronger juxtaposition there. Again, it's so Bitcoin. Like you're not going to get free Bitcoin every month, but like you'll get free US dollars. But like. You better use it the way that we want you to. So I think that'll be the way of appeasing this. Now, obviously, I think that's a means of kicking the can further down the road. I don't know how this is going to play out. I'm probably really wrong. but that's my theory for now.
Well, I hope you're really right about Bitcoin.
me
yeah,
too.
We'll see how it plays out precisely. But I'm curious. I mean, just like personally, how has Bitcoin and your knowledge has increased, how has that changed your view, like your time preference and the way you think about saving and investing and, you know, you're renting now so you could sell your house and buy more Bitcoin. I mean, can you just talk a little bit about like the personal impact that Bitcoin's had on you?
Yeah. Sorry, I'm distracted. There's a guy walking around outside my window with a red tuxedo on.
That's normal. If you need to take care of it, man, go protect your.
It's a Wednesday morning. What are you doing, dude? Looks like he's going to prom. let's see. My office is in front of the courthouse. I wonder if he's going to go into court with a red tux on. Sorry, this is way off.
Be a good look for the judge.
Yeah, show up with your best garb on. They're going to let you off of that thing.
That's amazing.
How has Bitcoin sort of changed me? I've always been very considerate of long term. Like I'm good at living in the moment and enjoying things. Like with anything I do, I always just naturally gravitate to considering like big long term impact. So Bitcoin naturally fits with me there. I've always been super frugal. I would say the biggest thing that comes to mind would be the regular consideration of opportunity cost in pricing things in USD versus Bitcoin. And that even goes to like my business and other assets. Like prior is like, okay, I own a house. Like for instance, okay, so my house we bought in town here, we bought in December of 19 for $258. I told you like renting now. So old house went, we listed it for $470. So you could look at, wow, that appreciated really well. That was a good purchase. You could price it in Bitcoin though, where, you know, whatever, I could have bought it for, I don't know, Bitcoin price at that point. Let's call
a few
it 20,
a few hundred or like 10 tens of Bitcoin or something like that.
Yeah, maybe like I think 25 Bitcoin or something like that.
Yeah.
And now selling it, it's like 4 or no. Yeah. Anyways, 10. Whatever. I'm not good at math right now. Anyways, you get my point. Is you price this in Bitcoin, and it's like, wait a second, what am I doing? And then, yeah, you could, like, right now, it's like, oh, well, Jim, you could go buy another house. Maybe interest rates will drop a bunch, and the housing market runs up. And it's like, yeah, but runs up compared to what? Is it running up in nominal terms or in Bitcoin adjusted terms? Heck, even my business, like I love running a business. I love what I do, and super fun. But I have to be considerate of, like, one, like when I invest in my business through marketing or through hiring, is that investment going to beat Bitcoin? And then, like, even the value of my business, like if I continue to grow my business and then one day sell it in 20 years, will it be able to get me as much Bitcoin as it could today if I just sold it today? And like, these are things that really reframe the denomination in Bitcoin. So Bitcoin, I mean, in that sense, it helps. It's fun as an exercise to think through valuing things. How it's changed me. I come across people on Twitter a lot who are like, wow, it really changed the way I think through things or whatever. Like, I don't know. Maybe I'm more open to what people would call conspiracy theories because of Bitcoin. That probably came in tandem. My brother-in-law is super if he listens to this, he's crazy. But I mean, he's right. So yeah, I think Bitcoin sort of comes with those things. Like, wait a second, I'm going to pull a thread on this. And look, the thread led something real. Like, what else out there? So I would say it probably loosened me up to some of that as well.
Yeah,
like my CBDC theory. I think that's probably commonly held by Bitcoiners is what I proposed there. And I think to most normal people, that sounds insane.
Yeah, the idea that we could ever turn into China, you know, social credit scores, you know, you have to accept CBDC, you know, for you to run a business or anything like that sounds like, you know, this futuristic dystopian novel or something, but it's playing out. I mean, it's playing out. Will it play out? You know, I don't know in its entirety, but it seems to be. As my brother said, you're not a conspiracy theorist if you're always right. So hopefully that's so hey, last question for you, man. We're coming up on an hour here. Predictions for Bitcoin and price predictions, if you're willing. I know you got to maybe be a little more careful as a financial advisor, but just anything else you're excited about or anticipating in Bitcoin over the next 12 to 18 months, say.
I'm anticipating it going up, and I'm
how much
excited for that. I mean, what I tell myself is 150 is where we'll hit. You know, most people would say that's bearish. The funny thing is, like, yeah, pretty much any Bitcoiner out there is like, dude, that's so bearish of you. But if you told anyone a traditional asset, like conservatively, I think it's going to double in the next year to 18 months, they'd be like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
But I honestly, like, that is my personal thought on that. That's not guaranteed, all the disclosures.
Not financial advice.
All that stuff. I personally think that's reasonable. And the way I've put my money says, yeah, I think that's fair to think. So who knows? Again, I'm probably really, really wrong there. I hope I'm really wrong to the downside. But we will see. Yeah, I'm excited just to see, like, I mean, each cycle is fun to watch from who's adopting this sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I think last cycle, there was this big hype of institutional adoption. I mean, heck, even two cycles ago with the ICOs. So there was sort of this thought of institutional, but in like a weird way. Last cycle, there was a thought of institutional adoption in what we thought was going to be realistic and everything with like MicroStrategy and El Salvador. We thought this is it. But I think where we are, like, we are in a place we really could start seeing more institutional adoption. I don't think it'll be many like publicly traded companies, but more like family offices and funds, and then like financial institutions adopting this in small manners, maybe like inside of life cycle funds and 401ks. I think there's a good chance we'll see that this cycle. I don't think that we'll see this like massive corporate adoption this cycle. At least, again, I'll probably eat these words in 12 months. But like, I don't see that right now. I think that would just still, there's too much perception of like, you're a lunatic if you do that. I think that's probably another cycle or two out. Again, I'm probably wrong. Everything I'm saying, I'm probably wrong about, but so are you.
exactly.
I love talking to people who are willing to admit, like, I don't know. Yeah. And so that's where I am. I don't know. Like, let's just try to arrive at things logically and be. That's what gets me about like Bitcoin and all the traditional financial advisors and all that stuff. It's like, let's just have intellectual consistency and integrity. And that's what's frustrating is a lot of financial planners, especially the ones that I run around with who are like deep, like certified financial planners who are in this area of, yeah, super deep financial planning. They're intellectually curious and actually have high intellectual curiosity and integrity when it comes to financial planning. Yet that stops the moment Bitcoin comes up. And it's like, mm-hmm. dude, just be consistent. Like yeah. now you're being hypocritical. And I honestly see a lot in Bitcoin as well. Like, I mean, people talking about, like you mentioned, Christianity earlier. I see this in Bitcoin all the time. Like Max Kaiser tweeting a month ago that Bitcoin's God. It's like, dude, are you in, like, maybe he meant it tongue in cheek, but like, you don't say that tongue in cheek. That is absolutely foolish. Yeah. And the, if, whether he's serious or not, obviously he doesn't think that Jesus Christ is God. And I would say, like, if you actually think that a created thing is God, then the intellectual dishonesty and lack of intellectual consistency is astounding. And it's like, dude, you can own Bitcoin and think that you reach the end of this rabbit hole and you're enlightened. It's like, dude, you just figured out something with money. Like, continue to have that level of curiosity and integrity and everything else. And if you don't know, admit you don't know. Don't start making things up, because that's the same thing that bothers Bitcoiners about non-Bitcoiners when it comes to money. It's like, dude, so many Bitcoiners do that with other things as well. Like, so many people out there who own Bitcoin think they understand, like, oh, I know everything now. Like, you know, yeah. they equate understanding Bitcoin to all of life. It's like, all right, dude, what you've arrived at is realizing you should ask more questions, not I've answered one question, therefore I know them all. Like, how have you not learned the lesson already? So, yeah. Sorry, soapbox.
No. I love that, man. Hey, let's end on the hot take. That's good. Last thing for you, Jim, just give a handoff. Where can people find you? Hey, by the way, I actually had a call with someone yesterday and I think they misunderstood what the Bitcoin way did. And they were asking me if they should sell off their, if they should cash out their pension, take a 30% tax hit and buy Bitcoin. And I said, hey, there's a guy I'm interviewing tomorrow who I think would probably better answer that question. So I gave her your information. So if you've got someone asking, that's that was a referral from me.
Yeah, I appreciate it. No, pension person out there. Like, yeah, I've looked under the hood of so many pensions, that black box. And like, I'm not going to speak directly to yours, but like, you should probably be aware of, try to figure out what's in there, the longevity tables are using, things like that, cashing it out, like into cash. You're going to take a massive tax and maybe penalty hit depending on your age, but, it's worth putting on the table as far as even options, cashing out, moving it to an IRA, converting it to a Roth. I don't know. Like, yeah, these are questions you should at least ask, not just dismiss. No, I appreciate that. I mean, yeah, the website, it's, my company, it's called Intentional Living FP, as in financial planning. So Intentional Living FP. You can find me at intentionallivingfp.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Jim Kreider TX, as in Texas. On my website, there's my calendar. If you want to throw 15 minutes on there, even if it's just you have a quick question, more than happy to answer that for you.
Terrific. Jim, thank you so much for your time, man. This has been a blast.
Yeah. Thanks, Michael.
Cheers. And that's a wrap. Again, I appreciate you being here. Check out Jim and Intentional Living and all the work that he's doing. He's doing some great things for the Bitcoin space, and I think is a voice of reason when it comes to financial planning. Also, if you need help with self-custody, check out The Bitcoin Way. You can find us at thebitcoinway.com/podcast. Schedule a free consultation about your custody setup. And you can also find us on X at @thebitcoinway_. And if you want to follow me on X, reach out if you have questions, comments, complaints, preferably not. It's at the other M Jordan on X. And you can read my weekly Bitcoin newsletter. It's just a personal newsletter. It's blackhatbitcoin.substack.com. Again, I appreciate you being here. Until next time, this is Michael Jordan signing off.